Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCrit Podcast. Today on the podcast, we're going to do a little steel man debate on a topic that has caused some controversy on Twitter, which is, in cardiac arrest in the field, should there be termination on scene or should there be a transport in a subset of patients to a resuscitation center? And the person I have on the show to answer that is the perfect person. It is Howie Mell, known to all the folks involved in SMAC Force, known to most people in the EMS community. Howie is a reservist emergency physician with Vertuity, and he is the chair of the ACEP subcommittee on EMS education. And he is the host of the podcast, So What 2.0 with Emergency Medicine News. Now, before we get into Howie and I fighting this out in the cage, one comment. The Resuscitation Crisis Manual. Folks have been emailing me, where's my books? I feel your pain, but I have nothing to do with the publishing side of this. I am so sorry if you're having problems. What I've been told by the publishers is that the huge demand has actually outstripped the availability of the special paper these books are printed on, because they're on waterproof paper. They had no idea the demand would be what they are, and they are finding different suppliers for this paper. They're going to get you to you. Hopefully, they've sent you emails saying this. They have your orders, and there is no quicker way to get the books than having placed the orders. If you didn't place the orders, then you'd be that much further back in the queue and would be even longer till you get your book. They apologize. They have the electronic books for you the second you place the order. You could continue ordering now. Just understand, it's probably going to be a few weeks before those books are shipped, because they have to source paper to actually print the books on. So that's the deal. Okay, enough of that. Let's get right to the debate. So here's what we're agreeing to up front. We're dealing with adults, because as you mentioned in your tweets, peds, entirely separate issue, and we're not even going to talk about them, but someone smarter than me probably could talk to you about it for a while. Asystole without signs of life, I think both of us agree there is no reason to risk transporting that patient, run it for a little while, terminate in the field, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And we both agree absolutely that there are EMS services and EDs in some parts of the country and the world where EMS is going to do a better job of running that arrest than where you're going to bring the patient. If you brought them to the ED, you might as well terminate those in the field as well.
I agree. I think we have to be careful of saying a better job, but rather saying that it is places where there just may be some setup that's going to make it difficult. It may be that it's very far. There may be something structurally. It's not necessarily skill.
Yeah, this is not going to impugn providers. This is going to impugn situations. And I think we're both in agreement on that. That's why I say EDs and not emergency physicians, because the problem is not them, it is their setting. And then there are some venues where the emergency docs may be amazing and the setting may be okay, but for whatever reason, because of culture, they're not doing anything beyond rote ACLS, in which case the medics could do as good a job easily as that EP is going to do.
Absolutely.
Okay. And then the last one I'm going to add, just so I save my own ass, is that in my estimation, and this is true, this is not just pandering, I could train at least the EMS folks in our EMS service to do anything I do, short of a few things. I'm not sure they're going to be doing ECMO, but short of that, I could train them to do all the stuff I have available to me. So the problem is not them in the field. The problem is the resources and technologies they have available to them.
Oh, wait, absolutely. Because I put ultrasounds on my ambulances for the very purpose of aiding in decision-making in end of life, right? We wanted to know, is this a viable PEA where we've got lots of cardiac motion, or is this, there's electrical activity, but I can't even detect the wall motion. And you and I both know that those two have very different portents. So absolutely. No, I fully agree with you. I would actually disagree. I think you probably could talk them into ECMO if you're willing to go the ultrasound route. I mean, I think that gets to the crux of the debate. So, I mean, if you raise a recording, we can get to question one right off the bat because of what you just said.
Yeah, let's hear it.
So this is the issue, right? It's public health versus a medical model to EMS. This is the crux of it. Take the president of the United States. This is not a political thing. I'm talking about the office of the president of the United States, right? The individual, whoever it is that occupies that office, travels around with an ambulance behind them. The ambulance has a nurse practitioner who's a very well-trained. They also has a couple of paramedics. They have typed and cross-matched blood specifically for the president, and they are ready to go at a moment's notice. Now, we can all agree that their outcomes for any situation involving the president are probably better than the average EMS system's outcomes. Is that a fair point?
I think so.
But it comes at great cost, right? And we couldn't obviously do that for every individual in the United States. Likewise, there are some areas, as we both know, in the United States where you call for an ambulance and you're going to wait a half of an hour for a couple of volunteer EMT basics. So somewhere in between there, the latter example being the lowest cost we can envision, and the president of the United States' EMS setup being the highest cost we can envision, somewhere in there is the provision of EMS. And the question becomes, where do you put your resources, right? And so I take the view that EMS is a public health entity. And if I can write a protocol that's going to save 90% of the people 90% of the time, I'm the greatest public health entity that has ever come into being. Now, intrinsic in that, I have to accept that I can't save them all. And that's almost an anathema to you and I as emergency physicians, because we look at the patient who comes in and we say, do everything to save that individual patient. And that's where the crux of this argument comes in. I'm not necessarily saying that you can't do ECMO. I am suggesting that the situations in which ECMO is going to be that helpful are rare enough that the costs to train is a decreasing return. And we're spending a lot of money and a lot of effort and a lot of training often in situations where we haven't maximized the routine, right? We want to do the super sexy stuff and we don't want to do the basic stuff. And that's my issue with this.
Okay, if I'm understanding what you're saying correctly, you're saying that we should maximize the things that will maximize good for the most people and not concentrate on the things that may be sexier but have little return when you actually look at how many people it will help. Is that fair so far?
Yes.
Okay. But that seems to be a slightly straw man situation, because I don't want to do any sexy stuff in the field.
No, that's not true. I mean, I think you do. If we're going to talk about these, when we talk about programs like starting up an ECMO program, right? We say, listen, I want to start up a program where I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to start bringing people to the hospital. Guy 50 years old, mowing their lawn, hits the ground, gets CPR, medics show up, coarse V-fib. Let's even give them an ultrasound. And they tell you it's coarse V-fib and it's really jabbering. I mean, there's a lot of quiver and a lot of motion. We're definitely in the electrical phase of resuscitation here, right? We think we can get this guy back, but they're zapping him and they're zapping him and they're zapping him and they're not breaking this. That's the situation where, if I'm understanding the argument pro ECMO, that's the situation where we're going to try and transport this cat so that they can get ED ECMO and hopefully go to a cath lab and get a lesion corrected. Am I understanding your position?
No. But I'm happy to play down this road, because I do agree that patients should be transported for ECMO. So if you want to continue along that, and then maybe after I'll tell you why I think that's a bad shift on where my position actually lies. But I'm happy to play that road, because I agree with you. I would transport that patient for ECMO.
Okay, and see, that's where my issue is that's where the sexy is, right? Because that situation just doesn't happen all that often. And when I look at, so when I was a medical director for Newark, Ohio, we switched to the CCR model, to what Arizona does.
And I'll quickly explain CCR here. Howie had a much better but much longer explanation, and I don't think it's that apropos that we go so far into it. So CCR, cardiocerebral resuscitation, created in Arizona by my friend Ben Barbaro. This is the concept of providing continuous compressions, minimizing ventilation, and really getting a good pressure gradient to actually perfuse the heart and brain, and then making the shock actually count. You could read all about it on the links in the show notes on this episode.
And we found incredible save rates. My guys actually got to a point, I've got a data set, I've actually put it on Twitter. We had a 25% save rate sustained for years of all comers. If they started CPR on you, a quarter of them walked out of the hospital neuro intact. And this is in Newark, Ohio. This is not exactly a wealthy suburb. This is the middle of the Rust Belt. This is a very busy fire-based EMS unit. And one of the other things that they did was they spent a lot of time teaching all of the community CPR, hands-only CPR. We taught thousands of people hands-only CPR. That stuff's not sexy, right? Doing compressions is not sexy. Spending my time training citizens in hands-only CPR is not sexy. Sexy is going to learn ECMO, and sexy is figuring out this new Lucas device that I can play with and bring the patients to over to the Ohio State University, which was our big academic center there. And we can do all this fun stuff. Yay. Go ahead and beat 25% save rate.
I see. And now this is the beginning of the false dichotomies. And this is the crux. So let me see if I could dispel these entire lines of conversation, because I agree with you. But you putting this out as the argument doesn't hold. And, you know, folks made the same argument, and it is a false dichotomy. And this is what it comes down to. Everything you said, 100% true. Absolutely. And I fully agree. And I think every EMS service in the country should be trained this way and do exactly what you just said. Unfortunately, there was one big study of this post Bo Brow's work that did not pan out, but I still believe in it. And I believe in the save rates you're talking about. And then you folks put that forth as your argument for why stay in the field makes sense. It is a false argument, because once you get past one to two shocks, all of your saves fall off at an insane descent rate. So yes, I absolutely agree. You will have, if you do the work you've done in training and you get EMS to do this stuff, amazing in-field save rates. Those save rates have no translation to the distance between shock 2 and shock 50. They're all in the first few shocks. Once you take those saves out of the numbers, it's a dismal success rate in the field. And this is not just one study. This is pretty much every study I've seen. You're absolutely right. If you do the CCR, if you get those first two shocks in, you will have amazing save rates. And after that, you will not have much incremental benefit.
I agree with you 100%. I will tell you that every save that we had was on shock one. Well, I shouldn't say that, because we got right back on the chest. But we didn't...
I hear you. I know what you mean.
Every save we had one shock delivered.
Yep. Yeah.
And I agree with you, but then here becomes the point, right? We're kind of saying the same thing. It's not a false dichotomy. It's not a false dichotomy, because I'm not disagreeing with you in that if we get past that first shock and they're still in some kind of a rhythm, we're not getting them back with CCR. What my point is that it becomes a decreasing subset of the viable, right? So if we take out all of those saves, no, hold on, hear me out, because okay. I can change in your head. If we take out all those saves, let's say we have 100 cardiac arrests that are within our preset, right? Less than 75 years old, VFib, VTAC, PEA, without any end-stage comorbidities, right? So we're taking the viable, believed cardiogenic folks. If we accept that we're going to save, I think it would be higher than 25% with CCR, because, you know, that 25% line is all comers, not with these. So let's say, for the sake of argument, though, let's say we save 40%. So we have 100 of these cardiac arrests. We do this active CCR stuff. And on the first couple of shocks, we save 40 of them. And so we take those 40 out. We're left with a group of 60 who were refractory to those first couple of shocks. Now we're going to say, okay, I agree with you. Can't win with CCR. We got these 60 players. We now need to come up with a path by which we're going to address these 60. And what I'm hearing you and several proponents of ECPR, as we're calling it now, or whatever these advanced things may be, all the way from dual sequence defibrillation through to ED ECMO, is we want to develop a system that's going to address these 60. What is the percentage of those people in that gonzo pie in the sky world that you think are viable, okay, that you think we could save?
Okay, we have numbers on both of the issues you raised. So let's actually talk about the numbers we have. If you made your EMS system, you know, you talked to everyone involved and you got consensus that every one of the patients who were less than some arbitrary age limit based on your system, and let's just call it for the sake of argument, 75 years old, no major comorbidities, witnessed arrest or signs of life, and VFib or PEA, you know, VTAC, I'll just roll into VFib. If you decided you transport all those after your initial resuscitation, your rounds of CCR, we're talking 7% would have to be transported to the hospital with immediacy. So that's the numbers we're talking about. So we're talking about 7 out of 100 players. All right. If we look at those patients in Minneapolis, Yiannopoulos's data currently is 44% neurologically intact survival. So that means we've already taken out your 25%. I've given you those. Absolutely. Of the ones that are left that fit those criteria, we're going to save almost half of them if we transport. Now,
and I hear what you're saying on Minneapolis's data. The problem that I have with Minneapolis's data is it doesn't seem to bear fruit in my experience. And here's what I mean. The suggestion that we would transport 7%. I was in the field for a long time, and I don't want to build an ad hominem, not an ad hominem, but I don't want to build a false medicine by anecdotia standpoint. But let's just talk between you and I. How many cases in the past couple of years of arrest have you had that were truly long-term refractory to your efforts to resuscitate?
Now, Howie and I went back and forth a little bit here, and he says he's not seeing these patients, but when you really drill in, he was saying a lot of these patients in the field after the first two shocks devolved into a fine V-fib, and Howie very well may be right that without ECPR, a lot of times those patients are not coming back. That is in no way a absolute or not even a relative predictor of badness for ECPR success, and they just weren't transporting those fine V-fibs. And that may be why Howie doesn't see these patients, and I see them in my ED all the time. If you still are in V-fib of any sort, and we had a good transport time, those patients going on ECMO, and these are the patients that come out of the Minneapolis data, those patients should come back with neurologically intact survival at a very good rate. So fine VFib, devolving from VFib to another rhythm, that is not a negative predictor for ECPR success. And that might be why Howie was saying that he does not see the numbers I'm talking about, the 7%. This is it. This is the crux. And maybe this is where all the misunderstandings come across. Okay, they went to find VFib. Who cares? That has nothing to do with these numbers. It's initial rhythm. In fact, I don't want you guys seeing the development of these. This is the key. I am getting a ton of patients at our ED ECMO program that fit all of the criteria, but they've had 40 minutes of resuscitation in the field. Now, Yiannopoulos' data would tell us those are still viable patients, and so we still do them, but our outcomes are not great, neurologically intact, on those patients. If you brought me that same patient after 20 minutes of resuscitation in the field, every bit of data out there tells me we're going to have an amazing neurologically intact save rate. That's the crux. And I see these all the time. And it gets worse because I see patients that are not viable by our standards come to the ED. They've been working on them for 40 minutes, 60 minutes sometimes, and I get ROSC. Now, I can tell you with 100% assurance those patients are not going to have neurologically intact survival. But I got ROSC when they didn't because I have a lot more crap. It's not because I'm a master resuscitator. It's because I got more toys. And anecdotally, those toys get me ROSC. And I promise you, if I had that patient earlier, there's an excellent chance I would have had neurologically intact survival from that ROSC that I can't get at the 55-minute mark.
But I think that the challenge becomes, there's a couple of challenges with it. Number one, it almost requires you to know in advance which patients those are going to be, right? Because let's assume for the sake of argument that I'm gonna be converted here. Okay. I'm gonna get baptized in the Church of Weingart. Right?
I hear it.
All right, and I'm gonna change all my EMS systems. Well, there's a problem because for the sake of argument, can you give me that, since we both agree that the CCR should be done for one or two shocks, and we also agree that I don't have a teleporter. So I've got to drive out to my patient.
Well, let me pause you and ask you that, because that's actually on my list. If we did have a teleporter, if you could beam me up, Scotty, would you have any argument anymore after those first two shocks?
I wouldn't have any argument before the first two shocks.
No, I think you should still shock them. You know, you don't know how ready they're going to be when the teleporter hits. So you do your CCR, you do your one shock, beam me up, Scotty, whoom. You're okay yes. with that. Okay, fine.
Then, I'm okay with that. Yep. Because you're getting the crux of the argument. Because as you said, as the time goes longer, you have a diminishing return. So if we drive out to the patient, we do our first two rounds, we load the patient up, which we both realize means even with the Lucas device or whatever mechanical CPR device you're going to have, face vacs, you're going to have to put that on, which is an interruption of CPR, which I don't like. But whatever you're going to do to move this patient with CPR in progress, it's going to take, I don't know, can you give me a minimum of an 8-minute scene time?
Oh, yeah, I'd give you even more. I'd give you, let's get out of there, ideally 10, but within 15 minutes.
So if we get out of there within 15 minutes and then we're, you know, we're not going down the street, right? Because we're talking about going to a place that can do ED ECMO. So now we're going to be talking about, you know, 15, 20 minute drive for most folks. Like, as I will grant you that if I arrest on the ramp at the Mayo Clinic and you zap me a couple of times because let's do it, I'm right here, I'm in V-fib, you know, zap away, and you get into the push situation, yeah, scoop me up and bring me into the hospital. I fully agree. And I don't think anyone is arguing that point. But as the distances get more than a city block, as the distances get out there a little bit, you get into this challenge of needing almost prognostication, right? I need to know that this is going to be the guy that's not going to get resuscitated because I got to start moving immediately. Okay. And
well, I don't know. See, now I apologize for interrupting, but I want to stop you to clarify this. I don't understand why you have to prognosticate. We agree asystole's gone, and it might piss off some of the AARP people, but just do whatever you want on someone greater than 75 in the field, unless there's something magical about them. You know, they look like they're 20 because they have, like, you know, a very distinctly different physiologic age from their chronologic. Let the EMS folks in the field make their judgment. But if we take out those two groups, first of all, most of your arrests are gone already. And so what you're left with, why do you have to prognosticate? Do your CCR, see if they have a shockable rhythm, and if they don't, get the hell out of there. And now I'll bat this back to you because I think it's worthwhile at this point to talk about. There's some doubters of mechanical CPR, and I think those people are just not following the evidence. You could doubt whether it's financially viable. You could doubt whether it's any better than hand CPR. I don't think it is. I mean, I see the videos of the CCR people who are doing this at competitions, and they're friggin' amazing. They're going to beat any machine. But we have evidence clearly it's no more harmful and it's no worse, at least for the Lucas, which is what we recommend, than hand CPR. We have an option now to allow transport. Why not just do on every patient who's not asystole and not old a few rounds and then transport?
So then my question becomes to you, the viability of doing the ED ECMO, because what you have to have here is you have to have the setup where you're going to go to a place that can actually do something with this patient, right? We both agree that if we do what you're suggesting, CCR two rounds and go, right? The classic patient that we're discussing, the 50-year-old collapses behind the lawnmower, their 15-year-old son starts CPR the second they hit the ground, as viable as we're going to get, right? And I'm going to pick up and I'm going to go. If I don't have an ED that's going to be an ECMO receiving center of excellence and set up to receive this patient and have all of that ready to roll, it's not worth doing. Do we agree with that?
No. Well, I'll change it a little bit and say if they're like, and we talked about this in the pre-agreements, is that they need to be doing something different or there's no reason to transport. But it's not just ECMO. It's ultrasound. No, I know you have it, Howie. Most don't. But transesophageal echo makes a lot more sense than standard. Arterial lines, Esmolol, dual sequential defibrillation, the ability to do multiple rounds of antidysrhythmics for electrical storm, a cath lab, ECMO, blood for those PEA patients that are bleeding, pericardial drainage, and thrombolytics. So it's not just ED ECMO. But I agree with you. They should be transporting these patients to a cardiac arrest center. If it's a regular ED that's not going to do any of this stuff, then forget it. But this nation needs cardiac arrest centers within a reasonable distance of everywhere. And I know in some parts of the country, that's just not going to be possible just due to the distances. And unfortunately, this is probably not going to work in those places. And we probably should keep doing exactly what we're doing with field resuscitation. But in places where there are cardiac arrest centers or cardiac arrest centers can be started within a reasonable distance, then patients should be transported there with alacrity.
And that's the problem. We build these systems, be they changes to the emergency department structure, changes to the cath lab structure. I mean, you know, you get on social media and you've got lots of emergency physicians out there bemoaning the fact that they'll get ROSC on a patient, and there are still cath labs that, despite all of the data, won't take these patients emergently to the cath lab when they've been resuscitated, right? When we get them back on the first or the second shock. We have so many of these places that are not doing things the way that we need to. And unless we can show that there's enough population to support these resuscitation centers, and I love that that term, right? That we're not talking about an emergency department. We're talking about a resuscitation center. We're talking about folks that can do all the stuff that you know how to do and I know how to do and lots of people know how to do. Unless you have that, this is a moot argument.
Yeah, I can't say it is. And it's a chicken and egg scenario, and someone has to give first. And I'll explain what that means in 2 seconds. What I'll say is this. If this had a cost, then I'd agree with you. Let's really weigh whether the, you know, cost and risks of transport are balanced by the number of patients benefiting. This is a essentially cost-free intervention. I'll let you respond at why I'm wrong on that. I understand you're skeptical, but let me lay out my reasons why I say that. Now, Howie, you talked about your own personal experience with an accident transporting this. In my EMS experience, this is a dangerous thing to be doing compressions while transporting. And I don't think anyone should do that. I think, you know, people who have suggested that as an idea either haven't been in an ambulance or just willing to risk their crews. You should not be standing up trying to do compressions in a moving ambulance. So if you can't get a mechanical CPR device, then I agree, this is not going to work. In fact, in order to do the CHEER trial, they had to get mechanical CPR devices for all the EMS buses that they wanted to bring hospital patients right away. So yeah, I don't think people should be standing up doing CPR in order to allow these transports. The cost of mechanical CPR is dirt cheap compared to all the other crap we do. And you don't have to buy one for each bus. Send a supervisor out there, which you should be doing for every single cardiac arrest anyway, and put that mechanical device in there. We're talking dirt cheap. And these are not like you have to buy a new one every year. These last 6, 7, 8 years, easy. So this is virtually cost-free. And the transport is what you guys are doing all the time anyway. And don't transport them quick. Don't run into another car because you're trying to get there so quickly. Transport the same way you would any sick, but not rushing to, you know, blowing lights and sirens, and do it safe. And I'll take the extra minute that might take to get you guys to us safely and gals. So where's the cost, Howie?
The cost isn't there. The cost is twofold. One of them is to the EMS system is training. I mean, that's just facts. Nothing comes for free. If we're going to talk about this, there's going to be time that we have to spend in training and in doing this. And training hours are very valuable things. I mean, when we look, you know, at a lot of interventions, we have to just look at what we're going to do and what we're going to stay current with. But I think the bigger cost comes back that I was referring to comes back to the system as a whole. That is to say, do the cost to develop and run these resuscitation centers is where I'm looking at it, right? Most community emergency departments are dealing with, you know, trying to undo the sepsis criteria, not going to invest lots of time and training and effort in doing this.
Okay. Well, let me address those one by one. Your issue of the training of the EMS, which you put forth, that seems kind of strawmanish because at some point you're going to transport patients. You're not terminating everyone in the field. You have to train your people on a safe way to transport them. And some of the ones who got ROSC, who you put in the bus, will lose ROSC en route. In fact, that's the most common scenario for a post-arrest patient. So if your guys don't know what to do, that's bad. And if your gals are planning on doing hand CPR in those situations in a moving bus, that's bad. So hopefully you guys have already worked out training for how to take a cardiac arrest patient in the ambulance, regardless of whether you're going to listen to me or not. So that doesn't really feel good as an argument. In terms of the resuscitation centers, all right, we could go into that on a whole different show as to my feelings on that. Anyone who's listened knows I don't think cardiac arrest should go to community centers. I don't think really sick septic patients should go to community centers. And I don't think there should be resuscitation being done in tiny hospitals that don't have ICUs to put them. But that's a whole nother issue. So let's eliminate that from the argument entirely by saying, if you're in a situation where there's not already within a reasonable distance, a resuscitation center capable of doing most, if not all, the things I listed, then just keep doing what you're doing in the field. But there's a lot of places across the country. San Diego, the entire area will soon be one. Albuquerque, New Mexico. My neck of the woods in Suffolk County, New York. You know, obviously, we've already talked about Minneapolis, the entire Michigan area. All of these are places where these centers exist. So let's just restrain ourselves to those centers. Howie, if that center's there, will you transport these patients after a couple rounds of CCR?
Okay, wait, hold on. Now we're changing the entirety of the argument.
Well, we're not. That's what I told you in the pre-arguments. If there's nothing they're going to do special in the ED, don't transport them. We've been in agreement the whole time.
Well, we have been in agreement the whole time, but I think that you're overestimating the population served within those areas. And I think that you're overestimating the number of departments that have access.
Well, tell me where I'm wrong of the ones I just named.
I'm not as familiar with them as
well. Let me lay it out. You come and take over as EMS. I'm sorry, Trevor, but you had a better job offer somewhere else. And Howie came and took over. And I'll tell you, we're all volley for BLS. We have a lot of professional ALS. Every single provider in the field has in their bus a Lucas device or some form of mechanical CPR already, because these departments have money to spend. And we have all the things I mentioned in my ED ready to go. Are you going to transport or are you going to continue in the field for that group we laid out?
For that group that we laid out, I'm fine with transporting them with mechanical CPR for safety, going to a center that can do something.
So we totally agree. But I think people on Twitter are not going to agree. So maybe you could channel their viewpoints, Howie. Why are they still disagreeing with me?
I mean, I would have a hard time thinking that anyone is going to have a disagreement with that. I think that the issue is that most of the people on Twitter are going to look at this and say, our system is so far from what you're describing that I can't put myself into that reality.
That right? makes sense.
I think most emergency physicians who are literally standing at the foot of the bed screaming at a cardiologist to take this very viable patient in whom they've got ROSC to the cath lab to remove the probable culprit lesion are going to sit here and go, what are you talking about? I can't get this stuff done that all data have already accepted we need to do. I think there's a lot of issues when you deal with cath labs. There's a lot of things that you obviously have worked out within your system that are often beyond emergency physicians and certainly beyond EMS's control to make this happen, right? I think that the folks that are on Twitter that are saying this will never work, this will never work, are living in a reality where this is unlikely to be set up in this fashion. And I think that their arguments would change dramatically, as mine would if I am sitting in one of these centers.
So many fantastic points there. Let me address a few of them. Both of us agree, but I want to really make explicit for the audience. The issue with the cardiologist in almost every case is not the issue with the individual cardiologist. This is a public health issue, and this is an issue done by the individual states and the public who is perpetrating this. They're shooting themselves in the foot, because if tomorrow those committees at the state level that decide on the statistics that evaluate your cardiology, your cardiac interventionalist, they change from if a patient dies, it's your fault, regardless of whether they had an arrest. That's the current New York State situation. To if you have a cardiac arrest patient that doesn't go to the lab and they had no other reason for their arrest, you get dinged. All of a sudden, every single one of these patients would be PCI'd tomorrow. So this could be changed overnight, and it's not the individual cardiac interventionalist. This is a state level idiocy that is just being perpetrated just from reasons I have no understanding of. I don't understand why this doesn't change. The AHA very soon will put out a really well-worded dictum that I think will make this happen, and then that will go away. You will not be able to take these patients to a non-PCI center, and they must get cathed unless they turn out to have a PE or something like that very soon after their arrest. That is my prediction. The second part, and this is what I meant by chicken and egg before, if we keep getting these patients at the 45, 60-minute mark, nothing's going to change, because everything we do leads to dismal outcome, and there's no impetus. If they do PCI, if we do ECMO, if we do all this stuff, and the patients never have neurologically intact survival because they had way too long a resuscitation in the field, then no one's going to keep wanting to do it. And this is what we see in a lot of centers. You need to get viable patients, you need to get some wins, and then people get enthused and they make this stuff keep happening. If you keep bringing patients 60 minutes into their resuscitation and they get a PCI and then die from a brain death protocol in the unit, your cardiologists are not going to be all that excited to take these patients to the lab.
I don't think we do. I think what we've come down to, and I think I want to make one other point about the public health side, because I think there is one other point to be made about CCR that I think gets lost in the argument, because one of the things that we're talking about, you know, you brought up briefly on the resuscitation center, and where you said, well, we also have blood and we have all of these things to take care of all these kind of strange reasons for resuscitation beyond the cardiogenic. I think one of the reasons that CCR works is because if we look at the fact that there are 400,000 roughly non-traumatic cardiac arrests in the United States a year, it's the data, which aren't really great, suggest that roughly 350,000 of the 400,000 are presumably cardiac. Now, I'll grant you that data is crap because we don't do postmortems on a lot of these people and we don't obviously know.
Every patient I die dies from coronary artery disease.
Right. Yeah. So we don't have great data, but what we do know is that the first seconds, right? We do know that a delay of even 30 seconds in starting CPR is huge. We do know that one of the keys to a good resuscitation is an early, fast, and aggressive start. We all agree on that, right? Two rounds of CCR or two rounds of whatever you're doing has to happen. We're not going to start by moving these patients. And I think the thing that gets lost is when you maximize your protocol for fast driven and the assumption that it's cardiogenic shock, that's a cardiogenic arrest, you can get save numbers that get very big, very fast. The problem is that you're writing off the 50,000. And so what I'll hear all the time from medics and even from emergency physicians is you can't do that because if you find out later that they were really a Percocet overdose or that they were really had choked on a piece of food or whatever else, that you're going to kill them. So we need to slow this down and do some investigation and make sure that it's cardiogenic. And that's crap, because the reality is, like I said, we can get 25% all-comer save rates by maximizing this. So what happens? We save 25% of 350,000, right? Great. So we're saving 87,500, or we can save 10% of 400,000. That's 40. It's twice as good to do the focus on hard, fast, presumably cardiac arrest versus trying to have these monstrous protocols that take care of everything. And I think that that's also one of the places where this whole stay and play versus load and go argument comes, because a lot of the folks on Twitter who are, for lack of a better phrase, in your camp, who are, you know, team load and go, are talking about the fact that there are other causes of arrest that may not be readily appreciated by EMS, and that it's felt will be better detected by the emergency physician. And I think that that's where the public health, the population base approach to this has to be considered. We have to just load our guys up with anti-cardiogenic cardiac arrest weaponry for the time being until we can really advance these systems better.
I agree with your premise and totally disagree with your conclusion. I absolutely agree. We shouldn't even pretend that these things are existing in the field. Just pretend they're a cardiogenic etiology, because that's going to do the most good. But if you then transport those patients to us after a couple of rounds of that, now I have a very clear signal. They've done better than I probably will all of the basics that are going to address a cardiogenic cause. They arrive in my ED. Maybe I shouldn't do the exact same thing EMS just did better than I could. And now start looking, is there something else going on? And I have all the technology and capabilities of doing that.
Oh, well, yeah, no, absolutely. But we're back into the same point because we're going back to your world where you have this resuscitation.
Not on this one. PA is a kind of different bag, right? Because, yeah, they don't have ECMO. They don't have TE. They might not even consider how to do a dual sequential defib. But if you are an emergency department of any ilk that can't do a rush exam to figure out what is the cause of this patient's PA, is there a reversible one, then just get out of the business.
You really, I'm just.
No, I'm not saying it's like that. I'm saying they shouldn't be working as emergency physicians. If you cannot do an ultrasound, get the fuck out of the emergency department.
And I'm going to ask you in all honesty, if we look at every transported PEA patient across the country outside of your centers, your resuscitation centers, how many do you think are getting a rush exam prior to or during the immediate resuscitation phase? I would venture to say that the number would be less than 10%.
Howie, have you heard my lecture on EM being a failed paradigm? I didn't say it's happening. I'm saying if it's not happening, they should not be really practicing emergency medicine. I don't care who I piss off with that, Howie. There's no reason. You should put yourself up as a resuscitative specialty if a cardiac arrest is coming in the ED and you're not capable of doing an ultrasound exam. How the fuck are you practicing in 2018 and you can't do an echo? You can't actually look for free fluid in the belly. You can't look for a tamponade. I don't want patients going to those emergency departments. And I'm sure I'm going to lose listeners on this. I don't give a flying fuck. I don't want them listening. How have you listened to MCRIT and you're not able to do an ultrasound exam?
Listen, I do ultrasound exams.
I know you do, Howie. I'm well aware. And I will add, if the problem is that your department will just not spring for an ultrasound machine or radiology has blocked you, then obviously it's not your fault as the emergency physician. But if there's an ultrasound machine sitting in your department and you just have not learned to use it, old dog, new tricks, or for whatever reason, gotta say, I don't think you should be managing cardiac arrests. That is, I'm sticking with it. Howie's tried to save my ass. He's tried to get me to recant so I don't get hate mail, but I'm not recanting. If you can't do an ultrasound, don't manage cardiac arrest. I think that's it. I think that's the point we could stop on. Folks in EMS, EMS directors, if you're transporting to EDs that don't have the capability of doing an ultrasound exam on their cardiac arrest, don't transport them. Totally agree with you. 100% in your court. And if Howie's numbers are really true, then I understand why there was so much outcry when we put this debate on Twitter. Because it means the majority of people out there are transporting to those shops. And I'm with you. Terminating the field. I got your back, brothers and sisters.
Well, and I will grant you, so we can end on a harmonious note, if you are in one of these areas where you have one of these centers that's really aggressive in resuscitation, they can get your patient to the cath lab, that can consider things like ECMO, but all these other things that you're talking about, we absolutely should be transporting there. And to me, that is the equivalent of collapsing on the deck at the major medical center. If you got one of these centers that can do this stuff and can support you, go. Get there. Get your patient there. Come in, shock them, do what you can initially, and get out.
Howie, this has been such a pleasure. If you want to hear more of Howie Mellon, why wouldn't you after this, then you should listen to So What. It's actually So What 2.0 now. It's with Emergency Medicine News. You'll find the link in the show notes for this episode. I thought that was a lot of fun. To summarize my viewpoint, I totally agree with Howie. If your EDs are not doing anything more than you're doing in the field, then there's no reason to risk transporting your patients. But on the other hand, if there is a resuscitation center that could do a lot of advanced stuff, even if they can't do ECMO, then you should consider doing excellent resuscitation for 2 rounds, 1 to 2 shocks. And if the patient still hasn't recovered, those are the ones that it's very unlikely you're going to get them back in the field. You should transport immediately. The transport should be done with mechanical CPR. And based on all the evidence, that shouldn't be an auto pulse right now. And get them to a resuscitation center. I'd love to hear what you think. I bet this has inspired a lot of thoughts. Put them in the comments section here. This is the perfect place because you're not limited to 280 characters. We could really hear what you're thinking. You could tell me I'm an idiot. You could tell me that EDs who can't do ultrasounds on cardiac arrest are actually perfectly capable of taking care of emergency patients and that I'm an idiot. I can't thank Howie enough. I love this man. Listen to his stuff on So What 2.0. Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast saying bye-bye.